you know, they're always setting up these regulations so that you can't make any money. You're always having there's always a block somewhere that they stop you and keep you from making money. Like they have a regulation where we have to have an audit annually. And, you know, that costs a lot of money too. And we can't bring our auditors out to the villages every year to do our audits. You know, we can't have an accurate audit because that's too expensive. But so our audits are always not correct. But it's always kind of frustrating to me to see that all these regulations set against us, I feel. And I think that's all I got to say.
Thanks very much, Denton.
My name's Sam Bedis, and I'm from Hughes. And I was going to ask if there's a way they could transfer the title of the land over to the village corporations so we could have more control over our own land, because the money could be spent, but the land would still be there. And is there a way we could transfer the land from Doña to village corporations?
Yeah, if Doyon and the village corporations agreed, Doyon could sell its land to the village corporations, but it would have to be a sale. It would have to be payment based on market value. That's one thing that you might want to consider. But Doyon, under Alaska state corporate law, couldn't just give the land to the village corporations. You might be interested in knowing how they worked out their land claim settlement in some parts of northern Canada. In northern Quebec, the Eskimos and the Cree made a settlement with the government of Canada, and they set up, they got a lot of land, just like you did, but they arranged for all the land to be held by the villages, and the regional corporations got a lot of money to spend, but they didn't get any land. The land all went to the villages. The other thing they arranged was that the corporations are not shareholders' corporations, that is, nobody owns shares in them, but every person in the village, as soon as he's born, is automatically a member of the corporation, and when he dies, he ceases to be a member. So that the corporation is perpetual, and it can never leave native hands. It can never fall under non-native control. And those Eskimos and Cree from northern Quebec actually came here to Alaska, and they looked at your settlement, and then they went back and they decided to ask the government of Canada to give them a different kind of settlement. So they managed to do what you're talking about. They have the villages holding the land and the regional corporation doesn't hold the land. Now that's another idea that you might want to, well, you've suggested it to me, so I'm going to consider it. But you'd have to get agreement, you know, you'd have to get Doyon to agree.
I have another question. What would happen to the land if Doyon went bankrupt?
Well, if a corporation goes bankrupt, then its assets are sold to the highest bidder to pay off the banks and anybody else that it owes money to. So if any corporation were to go bankrupt, any native corporation were to go bankrupt, it could lose its land to the banks or the mortgage companies or whoever its creditors happen to be. Whoever it owed money to could take the land. So that's a danger that native corporations face right now. That you don't have to wait until 1991 to go bankrupt. You could go bankrupt tomorrow. But it should be said that no native corporation in Alaska has gone bankrupt yet.
All right. Is there any way, are they suggesting to put the land, all the land, in a land bank or something? I mean, safeguard.
Well, Congress did amend. They passed an amendment to ANCSA back in 1980 to allow you to put subsistence lands into a land bank where they can't be taxed. And the corporation at Galena, Gunna U, is the first corporation to try to put its land into the land bank, but they haven't been able to get it in. Haven't been able to get it in there yet, and there's still a lot of negotiations with the federal government to get it into the land bank. They told us all about it yesterday when we were there. Pat Sweetser, who is the vice president for lands of Gunna U, explained all of that to us. So until they get theirs into the land bank and you see what the conditions are going to be, we won't know for sure how useful the land bank's going to be. But at least Gunna U is trying, so we can all watch them and see how they make out. But they've hit a snag right now, and nothing's happening right now because the federal government is trying to get its policy ready.
And how do this... Yeah. This...
Excuse me?
Could you explain the land
bank? Well, the question is, could I explain the land bank? I was trying to do that. It isn't easy to explain because it only came in 1980. And what the federal government did was this. They changed the Land Claims Act. And they said, okay, all you people in Alaska are complaining that you don't want your subsistence lands taxed. Because subsistence lands don't generate any income to pay a tax. So they said, we will set up a land bank and you can put the land into the land bank. And that means that the federal government will manage the land and it means it can't be taxed. And maybe you put the land in for 10 years or 15 years or whatever. But the land bank is still pretty vague. And no one has actually got their land into the land bank. The corporation that is trying hardest to get its land into the land bank is Gunna U at Galena. And they were telling us about it yesterday, and they still haven't got it in, and the federal government is still arguing with them about how they can get it in and for how long, and the federal government's latest position is, we'll only let you put your land in for 5 years and then another 5 years. Well, that's only 10 years. And so they aren't very happy about that. That's all I can do to answer your question because that's all anybody knows. Nobody's got any land in the land bank yet, but if they do get it in, then it can't be taxed as long as it's in there. You know, this thing is complicated, and I try to make it simple, but you can't make it, but it just isn't that simple. But anyway, you go ahead.
Got another question. What do you suggest would be the best way to safeguard against a large corporation taking over or getting into a merger with Doña, and if there's any action being taken on this?
Well, after 1991, Doyon could, if there are no restrictions on the issuance of shares, Doyon, and I only take this as an example, because you use Doyon yourself as an example, Doyon could issue shares to, let us say, an oil company, if the oil company would put up money for the shares to go into a joint venture. That's done every day by corporations. So that's why you have to think pretty hard about whether you want restrictions on the right of Doyon or any other corporation to issue shares to an outside company for joint venture purposes. But corporations often do that. They want to raise some money. Instead of going to the bank and borrowing the money, they go to an oil company and they say, you give us some money and we'll give you some of our shares. And then they issue new shares. They don't take your shares and give them to the oil company. They issue new shares. And then they get the money from the oil company, but then you've got some new shareholders. It's not just you and all the people in this room. You've got Exxon or Gulf as a shareholder with you. Now, maybe that's a good thing. You know, you should think about that. Maybe that's what you'd like to see. But I want to know how you feel about that.
Is there any way to alienate the land? I mean, separate the land and the business, I mean, the money part of it.
Well, a lot of people at these meetings, a lot of native people at these meetings have taken that stand. That is, they've said, why don't we separate the land from the corporations and let the corporations run the businesses and make the investments and so on, but let's keep the land separate. Well, we're looking into ways of doing that, but one way, of course, that Ganayu is trying is the land bank. In Tununuk and other Yupik villages, people are saying, well, let's turn the land over to the IRA council. Then we can't lose it because it will remain native land in trust forever. Other places are saying, let's try something new. One of the elders was telling me that you saw those programs on television that where we brought native leaders from other countries to talk about how they preserve their land. And we had some native leaders from Australia who said, well, they don't put it in trust with the federal government. They have a land council that consists of elders, and the elders hold the land in trust for all the native people, and it can't be taxed, and it can't leave native hands. So we're looking at new ideas so that it isn't just a question of corporation or IRA. Maybe there's some other ways of doing these things.
Do you think there's any legal way they could do that? I mean, just
it's being done in other countries. Maybe it can be done here. We're looking into it because that's one of the ideas that's been brought up. Maybe the corporations can look after the land. Some of the people say, well, let the corporations keep the land and they'll look after it for us. Some people have a lot of confidence in their own village corporation. Some people have confidence in their regional corporation. Some people say, let's turn the land over to the IRA council or the traditional council. Other people say, well, let's put it in trust in some way so that we don't lose it. I'm repeating myself, but
yeah. That's all. No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. You've got a lot of good questions. I hope in a year from now when I write my report, I'll have the answers for you.
Well, Tom.
My name is Wilson Sam. I'm from Huslia. I was born in Cutoff, or Kaikuk, and raised in Cutoff, and mostly in Dalvishloo. My parents was Sam Tony and Big Sophie, and they raised us off the country, around Dalvishloo mostly. And a lot of people ask me, how come I'm so big for an Indian. Well, I was brought up with a lot of good Indian food. So, a lot of protein in it. But anyway, we, I never went to school, and then after I got married, I learned to read and write a little bit. With the help from my wife and others. And then we went outside to go to a little training for a church, to work in our church and things like that. And I went to different meetings while I was out there to talk about how we live in Alaska. Tonight, as we sit around and talk, and I heard some people say, gee, look at that big land in Alaska just going to waste. You know, you could take that land in Alaska and turn that into a big farm. Just tear all the trees out and turn the whole thing into a big farm like Arizona is or other countries, you know. You take these two D9s and put a 100-foot chain in between it, and they got it going side by side, tearing it up. So as I was listening to these people, I said to them, I said, you know that to us, Alaska is not a waste. I said, maybe if you're way up in the air and flying over it, it looked like a waste to you, but as being from Alaska, I said to them, I go back in the woods when I'm hungry and I can get a bird in an hour or so and cook it up instead of like if you're hungry, I said, you go down to Circle K, you know, it's one of the snack stores. And you go down and get a snack for yourself. Well, me, I go running back in the woods and I get my meal. And learning all those things from our parents, they said, my parents always used to say, make sure you try to get the mail if you're going to go out and get a bird. They said, don't try to get the female, because they take care of the eggs and then they have the young ones. So make sure you get the mate. That's the way you preserve your country. You make sure that you get the mate and you save the females. So we learn all these things from our parents. Then it said, if you want to go out, get a steak, like in the fall time, then you go out into your farm. You know, this is our farm already developed for us. You know, it's not like they do in Arizona and places like that. They tear up the whole area to grow grain and hay and stuff like that for their cattle. But us out here in Alaska, we already got a farm, natural farm. There's blueberries, there's cranberries for our bear, and willows and good goose grass in the lake, and there's some just like vegetable stuff in the bottom of some lakes that the moose go down and die for and feed on, and summertime they really fatten up on it. And all those things they don't see from the air, and people think that's a waste to us, you know. But if you really get out there and you really look, you can find it. It's really important for our children to really know that, you know, we ain't gonna be here when the hard time really hit. But our children are the ones that's gonna take the punishment. Unless they get some education. Then they could feed the words back to where it came from, you know. And as we, one time we were interviewed and we sat on a mountain and said, this guy told me, he said, look at that beautiful land out there. You think there's nothing out there. You know, and I said, it sure does look like there's nothing out there, isn't it, when you're way up there. You know, I could see what the people's mean when they just fly over it. There's nothing on there. There's swamps and lakes, you know. But it's important to us. We were born and raised on it. And we never spoiled it. We never abused our country. We always got what we need. And if we got over what we need, we share it with our neighbors. That's the way our peoples are around here. We were taught that. I was very proud of my parents because my parents, if you go to their yard, they never had junks in their yard. What they don't use, they give to people. And for that, I was very proud of them. They've done a good job of bringing us up. My dad died a few years ago, but he lived a good life. He lived his life long enough, and he died of peace. And all his children's there with him. And that's nice. That's a good dad. But he done a good job of raising us, and he always talked good with us. And I see these peoples sometimes cutting these trees, you know. And we shouldn't cut too many trees for no reason. Because each tree we cut, they don't grow as fast as, they don't grow back quite quick as just the river willows would do, you know. River willows, you can cut all you want, but they'll grow right back. But when you cut a timber down, and then you never get to use it, you're wasting your children's future. That's a waste. So, another guy and I, one time we talked about it, who said, sure is a waste, you know. If the village nowadays get a grant for housing, and it, you know, instead of using their children's future from nearby our areas or township or things like that, since that money is a grant, I think it would be a wise idea to go out and buy logs from different area to save your children's future or the surrounding area around the villages. Because each log we cut and we let it go waste, that's our children's future. You know, in 40 or 50 years, we'll maybe all be gone. But our children will still be here and they'll have children and grandchildren by that time. And they're the ones that's going to suffer the waste that we have done. You know, like each trash we throw away, that builds up. And each timber we take, then there's less timber. So that's a waste when we're wasting our children's future. So every way we could, we should try to save our timbers like we've been saving our animals all these years. And another thing that's been really, really concerned me is that I really don't see why the children's didn't have the right to get their 160 acres like the adults did. I'd like to see that change so that each child could get 160 acres like I got 160 acres. I think that would, I'd like to see that change, you know. Because they're a human being, the same as the adults. So the 160 acres we got, I'd like to see that change. And I hear Linda say that our people didn't understand when they got, when they were offered to get 160 acres. Well, I was one of them that didn't really understand. If I know what what these 106 acres really was going to come out for. I would have went out and searched for a good land. And like now I got one, we got one land that's caving away, and that's almost useless. I wouldn't say it's useless, because if I have to pay tax on my allotments, I'm going to clear that land off and grow some crops on it. So I'm going to try to make it pay for itself. But hopefully, we never have to pay tax on that land, you know. Because that's not what the Creator gave it to us for. He gave it to us to take care of, and we took good care of it. But it's somebody from outside that really come in and create these problems for us. We didn't ask for the problem, but somebody just came and started making these new laws. You know, like now I hear people say, well, this is what Juneau told you to do. This is what Washington told you what to do. But this is what Washington told the council that way to run the village. Or this is what Juneau told the council to run the village. It's like it used to be where you can't have relatives on one council.
Sorry, you can't have what?
Relatives on the same council. You know, like I can't be your brother and then be your secretary if you're a mayor, you know. And now Juneau told them you could do anything you want. See? So these are the things that they brought these problems from for us from the outside areas to the villages. You know, a long time ago, the chief, you used to listen to the chief, what he said got to go. I think those were good times when if the chief said to do something in the village together, it was done. I think that was a time that was really good way, because people's done things together. Now, like, I went visiting in Hughes not too long ago, and the TV went out. The television was out. So everybody got a chance to sit on a bank, and we get a chance to listen to our elders tell a story. We sat there 2 or 3 hours at a time, just sitting on the bank and listening to the elders tell stories. And that's the way it used to be with us, you know. Elders used to get together in the evenings and tell stories. And all that is changing because of the television, telephones. Now you don't have to go run to somebody's house to deliver message. You just go to the desk and call on the phone. You know, all those things have changed. So you can see what our children are facing now. They're facing more difficult times and more bills to pay. Each time you add something to your home, you know that it's going to cost money. And a long time ago, that wasn't that way. We lived off the country. My parents went out and they trapped in the fall time. There was the supply they got for the fall. They paid their bills. And then they went out after Christmas again. And the supply they got during Christmas, they paid the bill for that. And then after that, they got a spring supply, and they went out and hunted muskrats in spring. And then when they come back to the village in the spring, then they paid their bill, and they got their summer supply again. And they live just what they get. They don't just go and got more than what they needed. They just went on just to live happy. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Eleanor Yack. I'm from Brooklyn. I would like to ask a question. Well, Thomas Henry asked you earlier, but I would like to know, you know, like he said, him and his wife, and they have, what, 5 children? They didn't get no native allotments. And myself and my husband, and I have five children, and we did not. And I would like to know, we fill out application, but you said earlier when you, that, you know, these applications could be lost or misplaced or whatever happened. But I would like to know what's going to happen to these people that did not get native allotments and if they could do anything about it.
Well, I the people that didn't get native allotments, it's too late now to apply for them. And I don't think anything can be done about it. I think that...
Well, I would like to make state another fact was... make another statement was my husband Al, he's a land specialist, and from what I understood from him, he said that if we're living, you know, like we live in fish camp right now, and if we're living on that land and as native people, he said that living subsistence, where we could get the land that we live on, but we would have to prove that we lived there before 1971.
Yes, that's...
And what do they mean by proof? I mean, I was born and raised there.
Well, you probably...
I grew up there. That's where I'm trying to, you know, raise my kids at least 3 or 4 months out of the year.
I'm sure that's true, but if you didn't apply for your allotment on that land in time, then it's too late now. Even if you can prove you live there and you've lived there for a long, long time.
So native people that did not get anything, there's no way there's nothing they could do about it? Or
yeah, Congress cut off the native allotments when ANCSA was passed. And so the people who received allotments are fortunate. Those that never applied in time, I don't see any way how they can get allotments now. I mean, you know, there's no point in my kidding you. I think that's the way it is. And I'm here really dealing with the land that was transferred, the 44 million acres that Native people, or at least Native corporations, received under ANCSA in 1971. The allotments had to be applied for in time, and after ANCSA, you couldn't apply for an allotment. So, so it's the. I think that's the situation.
So if you live there all your life, and then you just they, you live off land, subsistence living. There's no way you could get title to the.
Well,
if
you
live there, if you were born and raised there, and you're trying to raise your kids there, what could people do?
Well,
the people that did not.
If you applied in time, if you got your application in time.
Well, like I said, I filled out an application for both Al and I, but that was it. I never did hear anything.
Well, you should find out what happened to it. I can't do anything about that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just asking you a question.
Well, you should find out what happened to that application. If it was filed in time, there's thousands of allotments that people filed for in time and haven't been granted.
Mm-hmm.
They're all tied up in paperwork. Maybe yours is one of them.
I filled out the application, but I never did hear anything. And
well,
I'm sure there's, I would like to know what would happen to the people what could they do if they didn't get nothing? And they live here, they're native people that just live here all their lives. What happened to them after?
Well, a lot of people never did file applications.
What would happen to their kids, you know?
Well, their kids would have to depend on the land that's held by the corporations,
mm-hmm.
not the allotments, if their parents didn't have allotments.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's... So it would just come down to they don't get anything.
Well, they wouldn't get an allotment.
Mm-hmm. And if they lived off the country or lived there all their lives and they...
Well, if it's land that belongs to the corporations,
mm-hmm.
and is used for subsistence, then they can stay there as long as the corporations own the land and are willing to let them use it. That's why the question whether the corporations after 1991 will continue to hold the land is so important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I want to take.
I was going to give everybody a chance to start their testimony before I did. My name is Claude Dement, Jr. I'm a shareholder from Holy Cross, an employee of Koitlatsina. I am their executive director. The board hired me in October of 1982 to manage the affairs of their corporation. I'll try to relate my testimony primarily to the management side of it. I think you're going to hear a lot on subsistence and a lot of on land and retaining the stock ownership. I would like to address the management aspect. The Land Claims Act, you have to understand, was not a law passed because the federal government felt great sense of guilt by bringing all this tuberculosis, taking the whales, gold mining all over the country, taking the land. The United States government didn't feel any really sense of guilt for Native people. They didn't feel sorry for Native people. The Land Claims Act was passed because the oil companies wanted it. They wanted a corridor for the pipeline. They wanted the issue of the land settled so that they could make their oil on the North Slope available to money markets in the South. Indian people are caught in the middle of this. The nature of the act itself requires that Native people become managers, industrial-minded, within 20 years. America has been doing that for 200 years, and they expect us to do it in 20. This creates an administrative nightmare. I think all managers in the corporation, including the board of directors, are really under a gun in the sense of on-the-job training. Each and every shareholder does not understand a lot of what goes on in the management of the corporation. And while the board is learning, you can imagine what the shareholder at home is trying to understand and trying to learn. This relates to the stock ownership in a sense, in that the Land Claims Act was fought by a generation that included my parents. My parents belonged to that generation. That was the generation that looked to their parents and said, we have a right to own this land. We were raised, like everybody's saying here today. We hunt and we fish. It is by right ours. Except we only got a small part of what is entitled, I thought. Instead of 40 million acres, it should have been the other way around. The city should have got 40 million acres, we get the rest. It wasn't set up that way. Stock ownership relating to land ownership, even though it's all within one corporation, are two different issues. When you own stock, that is a sense of profitability or a sense of greed. If you want to sell your stock, you either sell it for money, or if you want to buy some more stock, you're looking toward the future and hoping that stock will be worth more money down the road. Land ownership relates to the subsistence of the people. By owning the stock and owning the land, you're looking at two different things. Although it's all wrapped up under one umbrella called a corporation, which is in itself is a foreign entity, but it's the tool that has been given for us to work with. When it comes down to 1991, people are going to be looking at that stock as a commodity in a sense. A commodity meaning something that you can get your dollar for. This means that the land is a commodity. And that's a foreign element in the minds of Native people, where you put a fence up around a certain parcel of land and decide that this package right here is mine. It's a commodity. It used to be the land belonged to everybody. Nobody owned the land. We were just guests on this land. In order to pull these two things together, I think what is needed for the Land Claims Act now is a strong spiritual leader. In order to be able to relate the greed of stock to the traditional ownership of land, there has to be a compatible area between the two to bring it all together to make a sense out of the Land Claims Act. And it's going to take a lot longer than 20 years. If anything should be changed, that 20 years should be changed. One of the changes, the land should be free of all taxation, whether it's developed or not, forever. As a manager and as the management of the corporation is continually looking for ways to save in taxes. This corporation, just so happens, over the past 18 months has been very profitable. We are finding out that taxes are something that you just can't get away from. To place an additional burden on the corporation by taxing the land is unreasonable in terms of the amount of capital that the village corporations have. If the land is taxed, we got much more land than money in terms of its value, spiritually, traditionally. It's just a matter of time once the land is taxed before the corporation could run out of money, unless that corporation is forced into other ventures that produces revenue. So it's a catch-22. But we're forced to make more money in order to save in taxes, to pay more taxes. You still pay more taxes if you make more money, but we're forced to make more money to pay more taxes in order to save our land. The corporation has examined all the land options relating to these tax situations. What are the options? We've talked about a few. The land bank, the IRA councils. We've also discussed the possibility of a local board of trustees, where the corporation, rather than going to the land bank or an IRA, forms a nonprofit board of trustees to hold the land in trust for all Native people. That was considered. There was also consideration to just give the land to each and every shareholder. Eliminate corporate ownership and remove the land from the money so that if the money is lost, the land will not be lost. Individuals will own the land. And one other option that was considered relates to the right of first refusal for the purchase of stock. And that is trade one share of stock for 1 acre of land. But the right of first refusal, I think, has something inherent that big businesses do across the country. By the right of first refusal, let's say everyone or 50% of the shareholders traded their land for their stock for cash or land and gave it to the corporation. This would consolidate the shares of the corporation under one roof, thereby making it easier for a hostile takeover. A hostile takeover meaning a company coming in with a proper down payment, going to a bank, saying we will put up the stock as collateral, it's all under one roof. This will put up the company as collateral, meaning the stock. This makes it easier for a hostile takeover if all the stock is consolidated under one umbrella. It's harder for a company to come in and buy up a corporation when 400 or 500 different people own the corporation. So the option of first refusal sounds good, and in order to keep the land, try to keep the stock in Native ownership, but it may have some hidden falls that we're not quite too sure of. And I guess all of these boils down to one final point. Says for each answer, there seems to be 1,000 new questions. There's never an easy solution to this. The Land Claims Act was passed out of greed of the oil companies. We were forced into a situation to either settle it or to fight a legal battle for years, which the money was low. And we're looking at it 1984 right now. In December, that'll mean 13 years since the passage. In December, there'll be 7 more years to go. 7 more years to become financially stable. 7 more years to figure out how to retain the ownership of the land. 7 more years to impress upon the urban centers of Alaska and the world the importance of subsistence and tradition to Native people. One other point I think that is for all corporations that I've noticed that has happened. My parents belonged to the generation that fought for the act. And for some reason, probably because of education, it's been young people that have stepped into management positions like myself and just literally skipped over people like my parents, that generation that fought so hard. I think that may have been a mistake, although we keep hearing that we have to train our young. That's right, that's true. But I think we've forgotten to look back a little bit and to bring back those who were first involved or those who were around. That whole generation needs to be back into the management role, because that's where we understand a lot about how the act was passed in the first place. As the old saying would go, those who do not understand or do not know history are doomed to recreate it, such as the wars and things like that. So there's a need to understand our history and to continue with our traditions. And hopefully, with any luck at all, we will be able as a corporation to preserve everything we want to do, come out of the management nightmare, stay profitable, retain the land. Everything that is, it's very, very